This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and when I start my workday, it always begins with that morning shower. Normally, I use a liquid body wash, but recently I purchased a bar of Sterling Soap Company's handcrafted bath soap and decided to give their Deep Blue Sea handcrafted bath soap a try. Immediately, the aroma of Sterling's bath soap was obvious, and in using this soap, I felt refreshed, clean, energized, and Sterling's bath soap helped me step out of that shower with the momentum and eagerness to get my day rolling. If you want to get a refreshing wake-up call in the morning and get your busy day off to the right start, I highly recommend going to Sterling Soap Company's website and order one of their many varieties of bath soaps among other products they offer. Visit Sterling Soap Company at sterlingsoap.com. That's STIRLINGsoap.com.
Stretched by Torres, the set, the kick, and the fish. It's deep to left field. This one may be off the wall, maybe in the screen.
Lang and Chernyshev on top as expected. They're eligible for Salt Lake City.
Indian Oscar. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Indian All-Stars, celebrating great Native athletes past and present. I'm Bill Black, and in this episode, I have something a little bit different for you. In previous episodes, I mainly focused on one specific Native athlete, or as I like to say, one Indian All-Star. Today, instead of a single athlete, my special guest will be talking about one sport, mainly golf. My guest today is Mark Wagner, an adjunct professor of history at Worcester State University in Massachusetts, who has written extensively on golf. His latest book, Native Links, The Surprising History of Our First People in Golf, digs into the story of Native American involvement in the world of golf. It's available to order online right now from back9press.com. I'm thrilled to have had the chance to speak with Mark and discuss his new book, his research process, and the incredible stories he uncovered along the way. We were so eager to get the interview rolling that I forgot to do the proper introductions, and that's why you're seeing this short intro. Now, without further ado, here's my interview with author Mark Wagner talking about his new book, Native Links, The Surprising History of Our First People in Golf.
Yeah, so along about 2 years ago, I've been writing about golf for a couple of years, and more than a couple of years, actually. I've always loved golf from our family vacations when I was a kid. I'm one of eight kids. I'm no millionaire's son. So golf rounds were very, very rare, you know, growing up. But when we went up to the mountains in the summer, my father and his friend, who was a Catholic priest, who actually was a pretty good golfer, would take us out. And we would all, you know, the eight of us would follow him around on the course. And I always connected to golf because it brought me close to the memories of my dad and his friend. And, nice. You know, so I was a decorated athlete in high school. I played soccer, football, the real football, I like to say. I played a lot of baseball. I went to UMass to play soccer.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. And I had all state honors in New Jersey, in my area of New Jersey, which was just west of New York City, sometimes called West New York. soccer was the game. You know, you didn't, I mean, I did play mini football for a while, but by and large, you know, there was a lot of organized soccer there. And in fact, you know, that's where a lot of the young girls started playing. I coached my sisters as I was growing up. And anyway, I'm a jock from way back, but yeah. I became an educator and I coached soccer at the college level, which I really enjoyed, as I mentioned earlier. But now, you know, my kids are grown and I started, you know, focusing on golf a little bit more, both as a writer and I'm playing a bit more. I'm trying to get a game together. It's nice. I call golf in my book, Native Links. I call it the least violent, most difficult game of human history.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you 100% there. The only danger you're going to get is from your own self.
So true. So true. I experienced that this week. It's the kind of game where, you know, as they say, you play it for your life. You know, guys, I see guys improving well into their 70s, you know. Anyway, long story short, I've been writing for Golf Course Architecture, which is a British publication. The Tudor Rose Company, they cater to the international golf course design and build community. Wow. And I've been writing for them for a few years, and I was down at Foxwoods in Connecticut, where the Mashantucket Pequot tribe brought in a fellow by the name of Reese Jones to design their course called Lake of Isle. And I was interviewing Reese Jones is a big name in the field. A lot of people recognize him as the son of Robert Trent Jones, who was the kind of golden age architect, and both his sons are now both in their 80s. Robert Trent Jones was a peer of Donald Ross and McAllister. I'm suddenly spacing out some of the names, but the great architects, Seth Rayner, C.B. McDonald. And his two sons are still at work. And so I'm interviewing Reese Jones, and I'm interviewing the historian of the Mashantucket Pequot tribe down at Foxwoods. And I say to myself, this is 2 years ago. I say to myself, so in 2022, how many tribes own golf courses, right? That interested me. As an academic, you know, questions are what drives, you know, you're learning, right? So I thought,
certainly,
wow, that's kind of interesting. I mean, like the Mashantuckets have this beautiful state-of-the-art, you know, golf facility. And it turns out there's 70 now.
Wow, tribes. 70.
Yeah. And a lot out your way, you know, there's some really high-end native-owned courses out in Washington.
That's interesting, because I think the number when we first started talking about this a while back, didn't you say it was like 55 or something, I think was what you said, but
that was kind of the official. That was kind of the official number a few years ago. But
yeah.
I have in my book Native Links, which is now out on Back Nine Press, a Chicago press. People can find it on Back Nine, Back Nine's website. They're in Chicago. We're starting to push the book Native Links: The Surprising History of Our First People in Golf. Well, it includes a glossary of all the native-owned courses. So I did a lot of research.
Excellent.
Yeah. That's the way the book finishes. The last third is a list.
And bucket it's list, all, as it were.
Yes. Yes. In fact, Bill, one of my friends said a while ago, he's like, well, have you played them all? I'm like, no, I've played a couple. And he said, well, that's your next book. You know, get on the road and go play all the native-owned courses, which at first I laughed. But since then, I'm like, that's actually a good idea.
Hey, that's awesome.
Yeah. And anyway, long story short, a lot of tribes, aided in part by gaming, aided in part by fee to trust programs, aided in part by just the land back efforts to create economy on native land, golf is suddenly in play, you know, and everyone's surprised. Everyone's like, what? You know, Native American to golf. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's one of the ways, in addition to museums and archives, casinos, that are driving, you know, trying to recover, right, from the history that we all know about.
Sure.
Which I do get into in my book. I don't shy away from the harsh history. You know, I'm very sympathetic to Me Too. I'm very sympathetic to BLM, but I'm also very sympathetic to, you know, I mean, Native Americans had the hardest turn of the cards, right? I mean, I think everyone knows that, right? But we've talked about, you know, some of these courses, Circling Raven. They had a partnership with the LPGA for a while and the Epson Tour,
right.
Thornberry in Wisconsin, Casuda Pines in Louisiana, Wicopa in Arizona. I mean, some of these high-end courses are designed by the best, like Ben Crenshaw, Bill Kaur, Pete Nalastai, the Jones brothers, Robert Trent Jones II, and Reese Jones. I calculate that they account for more than 10% of those 70 courses.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So they've designed for the Sioux, the Mashantucket Pequots. They've designed for the Auction Reservation Community in Arizona, for Talking Stick. I'm forgetting some others. The Dakota Sioux. But anyway, that led me that interesting question, like how many Native tribes own courses, led me to realize that this is a suitable subject for investigation and research, right? And I started looking into it, and you know, I'm not Native. I like to joke that I'm Poe White. That's my tribe. I'm Poe White from New Jersey. And sometimes I'll even say Kickapoe White from New Jersey.
On a rough day, right? Yeah.
Yeah, on a rough life. I'm no millionaire son, as I like to say. I'm not a country club kid, but You know this as a Native person yourself, that sometimes the Native community keeps to themselves, right? And so not everyone knew that, like, well, this is really an interesting industry for Native American tribes, and they have the land, right? And the other point I make in the book is golf is the game that requires the most amount of land, right?
Oh, for sure.
A typical course is 250 to 300 acres. And so you have a lot of tribes have two courses, right? You know, which is Talking Stick is two, Lake of Isles, where all this began, is two courses. Santa Ana Pueblo, where they have the Native American Open each year, also two courses. Twin Warriors and Santa Ana. So it really fascinated me from the very get-go. And then, of course, the real surprise was I started investigating players, you know, the athletes, Native athletes,
right,
that have played golf and succeeded in golf. And that begins with a gentleman by the name of a Native by the name of Oscar Smith Bunn, who was a Shinnecock Montauk Native. Now, there's where you get some irony in all this. The Shinnecock are still out on Eastern Long Island. They have a beautiful, although albeit a small reservation, on Southampton Bay. And it's between Peconic and Southampton Bay, some of the nicest land in the world, right? Where they were whalers.
That's a lot different than a lot of other tribes got handed, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, they held on to some. It's a really interesting story. But the white tribe came out and bought some of their land, right? And that tribe included some rich New Yorkers, right? You have names like Ford, Vanderbilt, Roosevelt, some names I don't even recognize. They bought a part of the reservation, the hills, right? The High Point. Mm-hmm. And they built, with the help of the Shinnecock, what is generally considered the nicest course in the world, right? Everyone's in agreement that Shinnecock Hills is magnificent, quote unquote,
wow,
or sublime, right? So the Shinnecock built that course with two Scotsmen, right? Willie Dunn, he was, and Seymour Dunn. They came over to spread the word of golf. And so one of the Shinnecock was a gifted player, and he came under the mentorship of Willie Dunn as a club maker and a player. And so, of course, irony of ironies, this all-white club which in its bylaws said no ethnic members, right? Their first representative in the second U.S. Open, 1896, was a brown man, right? Shinnecock Montauk, Native American player, Oscar Bunn, who was not only gifted, he played in two U.S. Opens, 1896 and 1899. And then he became a teacher and clubmaker all over. He went to the Adirondacks. And all this is where my book really begins, right?
Okay.
With this figure. He taught in the Adirondacks for many years. He taught in Florida. He held many course records. He toured around. He's mentioned in the New York Times. He's mentioned in the Brooklyn Eagle. He was a marquee name.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he was an exceptional golfer. And he, in fact, he went to Argentina to help build a course down there. And all this is recounted in my book. And his relatives are still on the reservation out in Southampton. And I'm quite friendly with them now. And they've been very supportive of bringing Oscar's story forward, because it was known. It's not, I didn't discover the story, right? The people out there had written about it in a couple of places. And as I said, there's a record of his course records. And there's a story in the book that when the great Harry Vardon, the great British golfer, came to America and toured America for 7 months, spreading golf. It really began the golf boom in America in 1900, turn of the century. He played Oscar Bunn twice.
Wow.
In exhibitions. And what's interesting, and this is something I turn up in the book that not a lot of people know, is that the New York Times reported that Vardon beat Bunn and this other amateur in their first match, but they had a rematch. And I turn this up. Not everyone knows this, but in the rematch, Oscar Bunn beat Harry Vardon.
Excellent.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So that's one of my chapters. And it's called Panther Thunderstorm, but it's in August 1900. Vardon, who I imagine probably took a shine to Oscar Bunn. Oscar Bunn was then 20 years old. Vardon was 30 and already had won the British Open twice. And he was warming up. That would be the year he won the U.S. Open. I imagine that they took a shine to one another, and he went back and played Oscar again, and Oscar beat him on this day. There were thunderstorms and whatnot. So I turn up some local press from the Adirondacks. And so that's a really exciting story in a lot of ways.
That is.
Yeah.
You know, you come up with things like that from, you know, 120 years ago. Tell me a little bit about the research portion. I mean, you had to dig pretty deep for some of this stuff, it would seem. I know that you said that family members and you can find some stuff in the New York Times, but what was that process like?
So that's a really good question. There's a book about Vardon's tour called The Vardon Invasion. And it's a very entertaining book where Vardon came over and he would play a local pro for supposedly, mythically, $500 and a bottle of scotch. And he went home a rich man from this tour, by the way. At that time, there was no income tax. And they estimated that he made about, you know, $7,000, which at that time, untaxed, would be a fairly good piece of money. But anyway, you know, it's a good question, Bill. I mean, I'm a real fan. I mean, my background as an educator, right? Libraries, museums, they're the wealth of human history, right? I mean,
sure.
You call up librarians and you tell them what you're up to, and they just love getting into this stuff. And so the woman at the Blue Mountain Museum in the Adirondacks and the Lake Placid Museum, that's where Oscar was teaching at the time, Lake Placid, along with Seymour Dunn. He would go out there and spend the summer teaching and making clubs. He was a great woodworker, Oscar Bunn, as was his brother Charles, by the way. Charles was a hunting guide, and his decoys are in museums as like the best decoys in history. Anyway, the librarians were so helpful. And in fact, And they really got into it. You know, I'm like, okay, here's this character. He spent a lot of summers out there. He played Harry Vardon. What do we have? And they would go and find these boxes, right? That say like Harry Vardon in the Adirondacks. And they start searching. And we turned up, it's really an interesting story, Bill, is that the family out at the reservation said, well, really, there's only two pictures of Oscar, right? There's one of him on his bicycle going to synagogue. You've seen that one. And then there's one of him in regalia, in his feathers, from a powwow. But I've now turned up three others, right? And it was really kind of a fun moment, right? I turned up one from Baltimore, 1899, where he played in his second U.S. Open. That was in a British publication. And yeah, the family didn't know about that. But he was quite a nice, he was quite a fine dresser, Oscar Bunn. He always wore a fedora when playing, and he would wear a vest. He was quite a stylish dresser.
Wow.
Yeah. And he was also tall. His father, David Waukes Bunn, was like 6 foot. And Oscar, we imagine, based on some of our findings, was about 5'10". So he's tall and lean.
Okay.
But anyway, the librarians are showing me these pictures of Harry Vardon on his tour August 1900 up in the Adirondacks. And sure enough, right behind Harry Vardon, where he's teeing off in a photo shoot, is Oscar Bunn in his fedora at 20 years old. And so I blew those pictures up. It's fun stuff. You know, it's just trying to bring Oscar Bunn to life because he should be known, right? He was a marquee name at the time. You know, and they would report, and the Times would write like, oh, the Indian, right? That's what the press called him.
Mm-hmm.
And he advertised as a professional golfer and went with one of the Park family, who were a big British golfing family, the Park. They went down to Argentina to help build a course. So, yeah, all that's a long way of saying that's where the history begins. It's fun. It's also it ties into, like, you know, what we both know and what a lot of people know is the ignorance of Native American history.
Right. Overlooked and swept under the rug and whatever. And then even people that accomplish stuff and you know their names, it wasn't the cool thing to be Native American during certain parts of our history. So it kind of kept that on the lowdown too.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you just look at what happened to Jim Thorpe, right? I mean,
right.
You know, the Olympic medals. I mean, I go into that. I have a chapter on that. I mean, just the injustice is severe, you know, particularly as it relates to Jim Thorpe. And he had to, you know, he was a good golfer.
Right. He was good at everything, but
he was. Well, I talked to his relatives too, and one of his relatives reminded me, one of his nephews, who's actually a very good golfer himself, Robert Comacheet, his mom is a Thorpe. He said he knows the family say that the first time Jim Thorpe went out and played golf, he shot a 76, which, you know,
it's unreal.
Just, yeah, I mean, that's just like insane, right? I don't know if that would ever be, you know, anyone ever did that, right?
Right.
So the history is fun. It begins with Oscar Bunn. It goes through, you know, there was a great teacher of golf up in Michigan, Frank Dufina, who was a Chippewa. My chapter on Frank Dufina won a prize this year.
Right. I was going to ask you about that because that's really cool.
Yeah, no, it was really great. I got invited down to Virginia and, to play golf with Tom Coyne, who's a great golf writer. He's also a very good golfer. So I didn't hold up very well in that day. but what can I say? You know, I have to, you know, you always got to be, as we say, you got to be wary of the really good golfers, right? What are they doing? They're just out there playing golf all the time. Some of us have jobs and family.
Right. Yeah.
And I'm looking at him going, you got an eagle? What the hell is that? I don't know. What are you doing all day? I'm writing books. But anyway, it was a really great tribute. Tom, great guy, really supportive. He invited us down. I was not the winner of that prize. I was a runner-up. The winner was Jason Ray, interesting essay called Yard Golf. But my essay was called Where It's Never Not Beautiful, which is the native translation for Mackinac Island, the native word for Mackinac.
Nice.
And it's really, it's a great story where Frank Dufina, as a young boy, loved golf. He loved shagging balls. And then he was there when they built a course on Mackinac. And they brought in a Scotsman named Alex Smith, who designed a nine hole that's still there. It's revered. It's a revered nine hole called Wawashkamo. And you talk about Native American humor. You know, that's another thing we don't associate with Native Americans, but Wawashkamo means to walk in a crooked line. Because the yeah. golfers, right? Like, right. Me, you know, we'd be like, where is that ball, right? You go that's, off in yeah. the woods.
That's and, hilarious. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is so, so much that is great Indian humor there. That's, I love it. That's
yeah.
good stuff.
And he taught there for 63 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And he's recognized by the PGA as the longest serving golf instructor. Obviously, this was before you had the certifications and so on. But, you know, the PGA has recognized him. Wow. And there's a funny story about that that you referenced earlier, Bill, is he won a tournament. He was a very good golfer himself, but he loved teaching and he loved being at home. He had three girls and he just stayed on the island, right? Which was considered the spiritual home of the Anishinaabeg people. Okay. And in fact, the women of the various Anishinaabeg tribes, the Chippewa and the Ottawa, they go there every summer, the women. And they take the young women there and they have a conference each year on Mackinac to teach them the ways of the feminine. That happens every year still on Mackinac. And,
nice.
And the term for the Indian term for the island is where it's never not beautiful. And it's in the currents between, I guess, Lake Huron and Lake Michigan, I think. Anyway, there's a funny story. He went off island to win a pretty big tournament. I think it was might have been in Wisconsin. And the headline was Red Man Has Game or something like that, right? Yeah. And at that time, this was the era of forced education.
Sure.
And like, I think it was 1923. And so he was worried for his girls. And so he and his friends went to the newspaper and demanded that they take that down. And so sure enough, the follow-up was full-blooded Frenchman wins Western Open.
Yeah, that's exactly. And so that's interesting because, there are reasons why people would hide that. And I hadn't really thought about that as being an angle. But that's really powerful.
Yeah, it is.
It's a funny solution to it, but boy, what a dilemma to find yourself in too, because it's a
right,
real
they
thing.
Come
for
and
sure.
They might have come and taken the girls, and they got to go to, school and whenever,
right.
Or sporting school with some nuns or something,
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really powerful story that shows the obstacles and challenges, not only to learn and play golf, which again, I say is the least violent, most difficult game in human history. And Frank Dufina, also, you talk about Indian humor. People would ask him, well, what's the secret to golf? He said, or, what's the hardest part about golf? He said, the first 100 years. After 100 years. that's a line that I repeat in my book that Frank Dufina said, the first 100 years are the hardest.
That's awesome. And if anybody would know, after being in it for 60 years, he says, I'm getting close. Wow.
Well, it's a great story because even before you have video or any of the technology that comes, he invented what he called shadow learning. And this is something for us golfers who struggle that, you can keep in mind. He would have people line up so that they could see their own shadow. Because golf's learning is implicit, right? It's hard. You could say, well, swing easy, or right. don't pick up your head. You could say all that stuff until you're blue in the face. But he had people look at themselves with shadows, and he called it shadow teaching, which again is just ingenious, right? I mean,
yeah, so you can see your setup, if you're dropping your shoulder or whatever. I mean, evaluate your own self a little bit. And then I can see how that would work at the time for sure.
Pretty, I have to give a shout out to Phil Porter, who is an Emeritus Parks Director up there. He lives on Mackinac, and he wrote a little children's book about Frank Dufina called The Gentleman of Wawashkamo. And I interviewed Phil a couple of times, and he had all this just great, great, great knowledge of that time. His mother had taken lessons with Dufina, and he was just so helpful, as was a Native American scholar at the University of Michigan. I should have his name. But yeah, Phil Porter in particular, just, you know, because he showed how some of Dufina's students would go on and win regionals, and then he taught his nephew, I think his name was Jim Dufina, and Jim taught a pro who actually won on the tour, you know, so that the lessons were long lived.
Wow.
Yeah. That's and anyway, impressive. That's a long way of saying that's the essay Where It's Never Not Beautiful that won the coin prize, which I'm very grateful for. You know, again, what I've found is, you know, again, a Poe White from Jersey. I just love these stories because, you know, we all face challenges in life as athletes, as people, as family people. And I just love reading about and researching and telling these stories. And not everyone knows about like the incredible challenges, you know, that these guys overcame, you know, stuff that we could only imagine.
Sure. Right.
You know, I mean, they rose above every card they were dealt, you know, in ways that is inspiring. It's fun. It's entertaining as well, you know, so.
Yeah. Okay. So tell me now about the process of. So you did all the research, wrote the book. How do you go about getting it published? What does that look like?
Oh, that's a good question. It's not an easy go.
I would imagine. Know.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, there's a press in Chicago called Back Nine, and their motto is books, golf books for everyone. So they have a more inclusive approach where some golf houses are about, you know, the 20 greatest shots of all time, or you know, Ben Hogan's, you know, perfect swing. Back Nine has a different approach where they have some children's books on golf. They have some books that celebrate Seth Rayner, one of the architects I mentioned earlier. Seth Rayner, who actually is buried out in Southampton. He designed and built some of those great courses out there. He worked on Shinnecock Hills. Yeah, a number of architects had their hands in there, but he also built the National Golf Links, which is basically butts up against Shinnecock. And he's buried next to Oscar's brother, who I mentioned earlier. Charles Bunn is buried in the town cemetery. He was a very well-known hunting guide for Teddy Roosevelt and the Vanderbilts, and doing shorebird hunting and fowl hunting. And his decoys are among the finest in the world. They're worth like hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Amazing. And
yeah. So Charles Bunn is in the town cemetery. My book ends visiting Oscar's gravesite with some of his family, which is in the native cemetery.
Tribal cemetery, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, I got off subject.
That's okay.
You know, I got in touch with Back Nine. I said, hey, you know, I've come on something really interesting. You know, Native tribes are getting into golf course architecture. They're hiring the best people. And then I said, I've discovered that there's a history beginning from the very start of Native golfers, right? Oscar Bunn, Frank Dufina. People forget, as we mentioned earlier, you know, the suppression of Native identity. Althea Gibson was African American, but she was also Lumbee from North Carolina. Wow, what an incredible life she had.
Absolutely.
Talk about overcoming challenges. She integrated not only tennis, she won Wimbledon twice.
Yeah.
She won the U.S. Open in tennis. And at the height of her tennis career, she picked up golf. And she went to golf. She loved it. And in fact, my book includes an interview with Joe Louis's son, the great boxer, who was also mixed.
Mm-hmm.
He was, everyone said he was African-American or black, the black bomber, right? Or the brown mm-hmm. bomber. Well, he was Cherokee.
Cherokee, yes.
In addition to white, in addition to African. And anyway, his son, his namesake, Joe Louis Barrow II, played golf with Althea Gibson and his father, along wow. with Ted Rhodes and some of the great African golfers. But that history has been suppressed a little bit, right? In terms of, you know, partly, I mean, not in any kind of devious way. I think just because of the civil rights era, you know, that was the cause, right? The, you know, sure. African cause or the Black American cause. But Joe Louis, his son goes into how proud he was of his native heritage. He married a native woman, right?
Yeah.
Twice he married Marva Trotter. You got to wonder what was going on there, but Marva is, it's a little unclear what her heritage was because of the Trail of Tears. She was from Oklahoma and where the five tribes came together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She was the mother of Joe Louis Barrow II. And they had a tempestuous marriage. They came apart. He married her a second time. She was a model and sang with Duke Ellington. She herself had an amazing history. That marriage came apart a second time. But Joe Louis Barrow Jr. Had really just incredible stories. This is all in the book. It's just, I think, just great stuff, in my humble opinion, about golf.
I can't wait to get my copy. I placed my order, so...
Yeah, it's in pre-order. It's going to ship in about a week or two, I think.
Yeah.
But the stories about golfing with Althea Gibson, golfing with his father, just amazing stories, you know, first-person oral history of how great a man Joe Louis was, his father, not only as an athlete, you know, but just really helping people out, you know, as he became famous. He had, you know, his son says he had enormous desire to help people, you know, and that was, it's almost bringing tears to my eyes. How much he went through, you know, and at that time, Bill, and this is something I make a point in the book a number of times, they didn't have any organizational support. You know, I see Noda Begay behind you. You know, he has the NB3 Foundation.
Right.
Mm-hmm. He's helping young native athletes.
Yeah,
so many ways.
Pretty incredible work. Yeah.
N7. I'll give a shout out to N7 at mm-hmm. Nike, out your way. You can't underestimate the and this is something I lacked in my life. You know, when I look back, I mean, I was a gifted soccer player coming out of, rough and tumble suburbs outside New York City. I didn't have any good coaching or, you know, any organized, you know, I needed cleats. I needed some decent gear, you know. Well, now native athletes have that. But you look at Althea Gibson and Joe Louis. I mean, Joe Louis used to recover through, you know, with unfortunately, drugs and alcohol, right? That's how he got through his post-fights.
Right.
But still had that human quality of helping people out. He helped his sister go through Howard. He would give people money, you know, because he was very successful. And then he helped integrate. He was doing exhibitions in the Army, and he was the one who started complaining about segregation in the Army. And he had a friend. All this is in the book from his son. Joe Louis had a very good friend from Chicago named Truman Gibson, who was a higher up, I think he was even Secretary of the Army for President Truman. His first name was Truman Gibson. And Joe Louis would come back from the exhibitions and say, why are the black soldiers in the back, right? Why is that happening? Because the Army at that time is still segregated.
Right.
And Truman Gibson would go to the president and say, hey, Joe Louis doesn't like this. And so by the time he was done his exhibitions, they were integrating the exhibitions.
Wow, and what a powerful thing that is.
It's amazing. You know, as I say, and he talked about, it's a great moment in the book where the son talks about how Joe Louis had enormous hands. And so you wouldn't think he was a good putter, but his son was saying that was his strength. He himself was a great golfer, right? And so the great story, I don't know if you know this, but Joe Louis qualified for the San Diego Open, and he had some sponsors. Chevrolet wanted to sponsor him in the San Diego Open. This is 1952. And Horton Smith is the head of the PGA at that time, says, well, you can't play because you're black. And he says, he gets on the phone, he says, well, you're going to have to tell me that to my face, right?
You know who I am?
You can imagine. You can imagine what Horton Smith was thinking.
Yeah.
The greatest fighter of all time is going to come out and talk to you face to face about, you can't play in a tournament that I qualify for.
Yeah.
And so he goes out to San Diego. And at that time, you know the names, Charlie Sifford, Bill Spiller, Ted Rose. These are the great black golfers.
Yeah, Bill Spiller, I know. Yeah.
They're golfing in the UGA, the United Golf Association, which is the Negro League in golf.
Okay.
But all of them, like particularly Bill Spiller, was adamant that he wanted to play the best in the world because he was that good, right?
Uh-huh.
And so all of them go with Joe Louis to the meeting. And Horton Smith says to him, well, your friends have to wait outside. And so Joe Louis goes in, and Horton Smith, you know, faced with the greatest boxer and perhaps one of the greatest humans of all time, says to him, well, you can play as an amateur, not a professional. And so it's really a great story. I could go on all day about it, but Joe Louis then says, okay, I will. And he goes out to tell his friends, and Bill Spiller in particular. Bill Spiller was so, he was kind of a bugging out character. He used to actually carry a gun because he was so radicalized in a certain sense, right? And Bill Spiller never spoke to Joe Louis again.
Because he bowed down and took the wow.
Yeah, they never spoke again, although the sons made up later. This is all in the book. It's a great story.
Okay.
But Bill Spiller was like, and Joe Louis said to him, look, we have to go step by step. I'm gonna play, they'll let you play down the road. And in fact, that was true. Even before the PGA eliminated the Caucasian only rule in 62, 10 years later, right? But it's a fun story, all told by Joe Louis's son, where Joe Louis goes out and then plays, and Horton Smith goes with him. And Horton Smith sees, like, Joe Louis had the biggest crowds. You know, people are, yeah, you know, bearing their breasts to him, bowing down to him. And, you know, he was like the most popular guy out there.
Yeah.
And he was an enormous star at that time, right? And Horton Smith realizes, we got to let these guys play. And so, in fact, it's true. The next PGA tournament, which was, I think was in Phoenix, the Phoenix Open, that's where Charlie Sifford, Ted Rhodes, and Bill Spiller were allowed to play. And so Joe Louis broke the door down, right?
How's that change? Excellent.
And although it was years before the PGA voted out the Caucasian only thing, which of course was just sophomoric in every respect.
Right.
Yeah. But there again, you know, native history, you know, it's just suppressed where, you know, I'm really happy to be able to have, really privileged to be able to tell the stories, you know, and reach out to the folks who are involved.
Yeah, that's great. That's part of why I kind of started this whole Indian All-Stars thing, is to help tell those stories or retell them and frame them the right way, as if, you know, for the youth of today, because it was, you know, for want of a better term, but whitewashed to such a degree that it was, you know, lots of cool Indian people in the past have done pretty cool things in the sports mm-hmm. world, and you just don't know about it. So,
yeah, no, it's fun stuff. When I get into it, as you can tell, I'm very excited about it. you know, I think it's, I'm hoping the book does well, you know, cause I think these are stories that need to be told. And as I said, you know, I imagine I might get pushback at some point, but as you said early on when I met you, this is now some months ago, right? Almost a year ago, I think we started
just
talking.
About,
you know, when people say, you know, no, I'm not native, but you know, hey, I got the skills to tell these stories and I'm happy to share because, you know, I mean, I hope I don't offend anyone when I say, hey, you know, I had my challenges too. And I wish, you know, I wish we all did for the native community, what Nota Begay is doing. Right. You know, I mean, coming up, I needed gear. I need better coaching. I needed mentorship about diet,
right,
how to avoid the drugs and alcohol, all that stuff, you know? And I mean, it's so sad that, Althea Gibson and Joe Lewis both recovered from bouts and racism and the challenges with drugs and alcohol. It's very unfortunate that we didn't have that mentoring along the way, you know, to say, hey, Joe Lewis could have been president, you know, but he succumbed to some bad health issues and whatnot. But along the way, just a tremendous human being in every respect. And as he said, I have a quote in there. He said, I'm from some blacks, whites, and some very big Indians. You put that all together and you have something.
That's awesome.
He's very, very proud of his native heritage.
That's great. I love that.
Yeah.
So now the book is out. You got an event coming up next week, right?
I'm doing an event locally in a summer education program. Yep. July 30th. And then, I have to say the USGA has been very supportive. I won't go into all the details, but they've invited me down to Pinehurst, which I'm really excited about. My family's very excited. Some of my family and friends are coming.
I'm excited for you.
They have a new event center, which is magnificent. I recommend that your listeners look it up. You know, they're trying to call Pinehurst the home of golf in America. And as I like to say, that's as close to the Hall of Fame of golf as I'm going to get. wait till they see me out there hacking away. we're going to play a couple of courses. And Maggie Lagle, the historian, another historian, Victoria Neno, very, very supportive of the project in every respect. You know, just the inclusivity, the message of support, organizational support for these young athletes in athletic year, in lifestyle training, in staying in school. They're on board with all that, right? Which is really the message of the book, right? You know, let's support each other not have to, you know, wait for these suit, you know, whatever. I don't want to misspeak, but just the powers of the Joe Lewis's and the Oscar Bunns and the Althea Gibsons. It's really extraordinary, you know, but all of us could enjoy sports, enjoy a healthy lifestyle, have our successes. And yeah, hopefully we'll encourage the next Nota Begay or Gabby Lemieux to step up and have their day. Right.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Fabulous. So something I always like to ask people, so you did all this research and stuff. If you had to pick one thing that stuck out that surprised you the most out of all the stuff that you dug up when you were creating this book, what would that be? And it's okay if you don't have one that you can pinpoint. I'm just curious because inquiring minds want to know.
It's a good question. It's a really, really good and fair question. It always surprises me how little of Native American history is taught and told, right? And so I hope that the book brings some of that to light and that we start including this amazing history as part of America, you know, and America that's, you know, as we see how history has gone and in our current challenges, climate crisis and elsewise, you know, yeah, Native Americans had it going on in so many different ways, right? That, you know, again, was just distorted by the forces of history and immigration and warfare and disease and all these things, right? I mean, it's always surprises me that all of us don't know this history and celebrate this history in ways that could really help us not only be better golfers, but also to be better people, be better parents, you know, be more caring of the earth, all of these things, right?
Right.
I don't mean to stereotype anybody, I think if we know more of this history and celebrate more of this history, I think we're all the better for it.
I would agree. And I don't think that you're stereotyping anything, because they were doing all right before anybody else got here. Right?
yeah, well, you know, you look at the Shinnecock, where they were whalers and fishermen and family people. You know, they weren't a warring tribe. There were some warring tribes, but you look at the Shinnecock, or you know, the way people have recovered from the five tribes in Oklahoma. Yeah, it's just a great story, and I've really enjoyed telling it. And knock on wood, the book does well. You're in there, Bill, in a couple places talking about boxing and your experience coming up, and Jack Dempsey, your quote about Jack Dempsey's in there. Yeah. But you also are quoted in the glossary, where in my introduction to the glossary, I mentioned you as well, in relationship to gaming. You were talking about your experiences in gaming. So that's in there as well. Just some of the, so I'm really thrilled about just getting everybody out there, and hopefully I'll become a better golfer in the process as well.
Well, you're gonna have to play a lot more now. You're on the hook, right?
As Frank Tufina said, I gotta live to be 100.
Okay.
If I live to be 100, maybe I'll become a good golfer, right? But anyway, no, I love the game. I love the spirit of the game, you know, the integrity and the perseverance, you know, I mean, the resilience of Native Americans, right? That's what I see in golf as well. You got to hang in there in golf, right? And it's going to go bad some days, real bad. It's going to go good some days, but you got to keep coming back. And, you know, we're still here is the motto of Native Americans. I mean, that relates, that speaks to me in terms of the resilience and perseverance needed for golf.
For playing golf, because, boy, I'll tell you, I have a lot more not great days than I do great days. But, boy, you hit that one shot, it's like, oh, boy, I can play this game, right? That's the thing that keeps you coming back to that.
Yeah, so, yeah.
And that's part of what I love about golf is that, you know, I'm happy if I break 100. I am not a good golfer. I don't play enough to be good, but by the same token, I don't have aspirations of getting on the tour anytime soon. So I go out, have some fun, and boy, if I hit a good shot, yes. Nothing like that feeling. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. And also, Steve, I interviewed Steve McDonald. He gives me a lesson. Great golfer, Potawatomi, ironically, a full-blooded Potawatomi who has the most Scottish name in the world.
Right.
His grandfather was adopted. You know, he has this whole rap in the book about, you know, being out in the creator's, you know, genius, right? I mean, being out in nature. Breathing the fresh air, and that's what more kids need, right? You know, be out
absolutely.
In the trees. And you see
a
turtles,
little bit of exercise, being outside, and just being able to breathe the fresh air and not stuck behind a little screen, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's one of the main reasons why I play. Just being outside, and I love coming on the turtles and the beavers, and you know, as Steve would say, you know, just in the creator's world, and you know, just enjoy it while you have it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great takeaway from this whole thing. Read the book, get some clubs, go out and enjoy the creator's genius out there. Yeah,
and it's priced reasonably, $30 Back Nine Press. I think you'd be pleased. I think your readers will be, your listeners will be pleased by the product. It's positive and hopeful view of our history.
Excellent. Well, when I post this, I'll include a link and stuff so that we can hopefully get it a little bit more publicity. However far-reaching we are, I don't even know, but.
Let's hope so.
Every little bit.
Knock on wood, as I like to say. All right. Well, I got to sign off, Bill.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate your time, Mark. I really appreciate it. And it's always a pleasure talking to you. And I'll catch up with you down the road.
Yeah, let's talk soon again. All right.
All right. Take care, my friend.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even write an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you gotta do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.